Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So tonight's the gathering on the new moon of April. End of April's coming up in a couple of days. Quite a few people here tonight. I always enjoy seeing that. Lots of people coming together. It's a Monday night too. It's not like, for a lot of people, maybe people have been working or involved in busyness, so it's always I find it inspiring to see. So there's two words that I've been working with, two sort of heart concepts or heart feelings that I've been working with the last 2 or 3 weeks in particular. And one is gratitude and the other is forgiveness. There's a religious program produced by the BBC World Service radio, which is available for podcasts. It's something I've been listening to on and off for the last few years. It's called Heart and Soul. At the end of the winter retreat, which just ended four weeks ago, I downloaded some of the episodes that had happened over the previous few months. And it's a very broad range. I mean, it covers all faiths. They don't seem to have any boundary. As long as it's a wholesome faith or religion, they seem to produce programs on that. And there was one of the programs that I listened to. I just found very, very moving, very touching, and very thought-provoking. It brought up a lot of food for reflection, and I wanted to share the themes within it were gratitude and forgiveness. Although now I can see how those two things can really feed off of one another and be used together, but they're not two words that I would immediately have associated in the same 25-minute program. The program was hinging around, and maybe some of you have heard this or about this, last September 2013 in Harlem, New York, there was a man severely beaten, a Sikh. He's a Sikh practitioner. He's a doctor, Dr. Prabhjot Singh. He lives in Harlem, New York. He works in Harlem, New York, in a doctor's office and maybe even a hospital. He works in the community. His wife works in the community trying to help people. They have a young son, 1 year old. And he's a professor also at Columbia University, so he's very engaged in the very local community. And one night, he and a friend were walking. They had gone for a walk in the north end of Central Park, and they were just coming out. And somewhere between 15 and 30 young men on bicycles, teenagers, surrounded him and called him a terrorist and called him Osama. They pulled his beard. I don't know if you know much about the Sikh faith, but men tend to wear a very full beard and a turban. And he was very severely beaten, and it was witnessed. He had a friend with him, but also two women were eyewitnesses. He was pretty lucky to get out of there in as good a shape as he was, which was pretty bad. As we know, I mean, every day around the world, there are countless people, unfortunately, that are beaten and attacked, and either for quote-unquote hate crimes or just some sort of senseless violence or theft. But what stood out with this was that what brought the attention to the media more than anything was the fact that he wrote a letter, 3 days later, there was a letter published in the New York Daily News where he wrote the letter and he said the strongest thing he felt was gratitude. Gratitude. And then he qualifies it. He says, gratitude for not being beaten so bad that I can't actually be writing this letter. gratitude that I wasn't beaten a half an hour earlier when I was with my child, 1-year-old child, and my wife. And gratitude that there were enough people nearby who were kind, who could help me so that, you know, I could be helped and healed. And this created a big, you know, it was very much noticed by people, not just in the local communities there in New York City, but, you know, the BBC World Service picked it up in England. Who knows where? I didn't do a big search on this on the internet, but and even his own community, which there was a lot of people that, you know, were like, oh wow, okay, this is we're noticing this. And in the letter that he wrote, which I did read, I downloaded that, and he describes how or maybe it was in one of the interviews that he did, but he describes how the police kept trying to get him to give descriptions, detailed descriptions of some of these youths. He said, I can't do that, it's just too much of a blur. They said, okay, can you give broad stroke descriptions? He said, nothing that will be useful. Nothing that isn't obvious already. And he says, I don't want these people caught. I want them to be taught. I want them to be taught, not incarcerated. I don't want them to go into the fast track of incarceration. And he was able to forgive them pretty much immediately. It seems, from the sounds of it, at no point did he mention hatred or anger. And in fact, one of the eyewitnesses, a woman, she sounds like she's somewhere between 20 and 40, I don't know, I can't tell on the radio. She's an artist, and she said that she was one of the first people on the scene. She witnessed the whole thing, and she said it was just one of the things that unsettled her in one way. One way unsettling that she found was how calm he was after being beaten, and you know, they rushed up while the youths were still there. And she said the other thing that about that calmness, though, that all of a sudden came was that he was, she found it soothing. Like, he was actually calming her down. She didn't have to comfort him. Comforting, that's it, the word she used. She wasn't needing to comfort him. But his tranquility and calmness and lack of, you know, his outward response was, she was finding to be comforting. And she said she's actually having trouble coming to grips with that. She says, I still don't understand. But she did say she just found it extraordinary, and she has the greatest admiration for this person. So part of this program, they went to his temple across the river in New Jersey. Gurdwara is what they call a Sikh temple. And by the way, Sikh religion, I kind of had heard this a long time ago, but the word Sikapadang, which many or most of you just chanted, it's the same root word. We undertake the training Sikha, somebody in training, or Seka. It's all related to a Sanskrit root word. And so it's the Sikh religion, the way they hold the word is more around you're a disciple or you're a student. So you can see the relationship. So that's a little bit of a sidetrack, but just to see the relationship. So they went to the Sikh temple, the BBC, and they interviewed, I guess, I don't know what they call the head of the temple, but guru or whatever, and then also kept interviewing this doctor and about how faith folded into it. But they also interviewed an 11-year-old boy. And they asked if he had ever, the interviewer asked if he'd ever encountered any bullying or any hatred, for instance, at school or in his neighborhood. And he said, yes, a lot. And he said, it's getting worse. And this is 11 years old. And the woman said, well, how does that make you feel? Does it make you feel angry? He says, no anger. He says, it's really depressing. He says, I get depressed. And she said, well, why don't you feel anger? And he said, well, they might not know better. They don't know better. Or they don't know what they're doing. They don't really understand what they're doing. And she says, well, what if you were to find out that they did understand what they were doing? He says, well, I would forgive them. I would forgive them. And I was listening to this, and then she said, but how do you cope? I mean, you know, you say you get depressed, and it's very difficult. And he said, this will pass. This too will pass. An 11-year-old boy. And when I first heard this, it was just coming out of winter retreat, so I was pretty wide open, but I wept. I was in my kuti listening to it one evening, and I wept a bit, just the spontaneity of him just saying, no, that this will pass, and I can forgive this. So this stirred up a lot. I was thinking, you know, I sort of started thinking, well, what would I do in an extreme situation where I was on the receiving end of either anger or hatred or violence? What would I do? You know, Buddhist practitioner, forgiveness is very much a part of our tradition, especially, you know, many of you would possibly have been here or even maybe participated in a ceremony of the asking for forgiveness. It's often done at the end of a retreat or a time spent together, or if, for instance, a monastic community, if we're moving on to live someplace else, or we've been spending time together, or go to visit a elder monastic to pay respects. There's a ceremony that we do, and which is called asking for forgiveness. That's in the English. And the first time I saw it, I thought, well, you know, I wanted to do it, but I did. There was a side of me that was a bit saw a sort of the formulaic side of it, and you know that there's a script. You know, people ask for forgiveness from the elder, and then there's a response, and part of that response is the elder saying, yes, I give forgiveness to you, but please, I ask you for forgiveness also. Please forgive me. But after doing it a couple of times, I there was something in me, in the heart, that really shifted, and I started to feel that at least my own personal experience of this was very powerful. Because if we don't forgive, let's go back to this doctor. If he didn't forgive, if he were dwelling in anger, dwelling in hatred, I mean, to say, or what if we were to say, I'll never forgive you? I've heard these words. Fortunately, to date, I've never used them, and I hope I never do. But I've heard people say, and then also, you know, back in days when we used to see lots of movies, or you see, you know, how many times I'll never forgive you. I'll never forgive what you did to me. And if you actually stop to think about that, to even conjure that up in the mind, in the heart, to say that, and then even worse, if you actually carry through with that. If I think of myself, you know, if I did that and if I carried through with that, that determination to carry that around, to carry hatred and anger around, and to hold that, and to say, I'll never forgive you. And then you hear a story of somebody who, it sounds like this, I mean, from the sounds of it, this doctor didn't even have to say, well, in 3 days I'll forgive you. It sounds like it was instantaneous, that there was no, this woman, that she was right there. She said, you know, there was no anger spoken about. She didn't see anger. She didn't see hatred. She saw tranquility and calmness, control. And so So yeah, I asked myself this question, and it's interesting. I looked up the word. I'm no, as most people know, I'm no scholar, but I do occasionally look things up. And I looked up the word in that asking for forgiveness ceremony, and kamatu is the form that they use. And then the word for forgiveness itself is often written as kama, K-H-A-M-A, which Ajahn Tinisara, Ajahn Jeff points out is the same word in Pali for earth, for the earth. And I don't know where it appears in the suttas, but I remember, if I remember correctly, there's somewhere in the sutta where the Buddha talks about how forgiving the earth is, that, you know, that you can burn it, you can pour things into it that you wouldn't consider clean, you can dig into it, and it never complains. It never fights back. And I suppose now we could say, well, yeah, but they didn't have nuclear waste 2,600 years ago. But if you think that the planet, even with everything that we're doing to the planet now, it's amazing how forgiving the planet is. So I personally, the way I'm looking, I can really see how those two words can, you know, kama can mean forgiveness and also earth, the forgiveness of the earth. But also looking up the word, the other words that it gives, the synonym in Pali is kanti, which is often translated as patience or forbearance. And when I looked up kanti, it said forbearance, patience, and forgiveness. So then that started getting me thinking, like, oh, okay. So when we're patient, like, for instance, you know, if looking at my own experience of attempting to practice patience, or maybe I was actually able to. So what is patience? Is in a way, I saw it as like momentary, moment by moment, forgiveness. Oh, okay. This is maybe more difficult to endure. But you know, if we can moment by moment let go and be patient, that there's, or especially if it's around another human being or a situation, that moment by moment letting go of the situation, and okay, I'm feeling annoyed, but I can forgive, and I'm blaming you, unfortunately, maybe, but I can forgive this. Can I forgive this? Maybe it can't happen right then, but the quicker we let go of that very thing that we find difficult, challenging, painful, the quicker we can let that go. So these are just some thoughts around forgiveness, but yeah, like, what is forgiveness? It's that, to me, it's just that it's a, especially around something quite extreme, it's a radical form of, yeah, it's just letting go of that situation. And I know that the phrase forgive and forget in English, I suppose it's still a popular phrase. I haven't heard it recently, but I don't get out much, but maybe in the world. Forgive and forget. But I was thinking about that, and then I thought, well, actually, forgiveness to me is the important thing. Do I need to forget? Do we as people, you know, when we forgive, do we need to actually forget? Can we not actually still have that as a memory, even if it's a strong memory and something? But the forgiveness to me is the key, you know, that dwelling in non-anger, non-hatred, non-ill will, that ability to recognize, you know, especially, you know, another human being, their humanness, they're a human being, I'm a human being. And yes, what happened was painful and was, you know, a mistake on whatever level that is, even if it was intentional. Like the little boy said, you know, oh, yeah, they don't know what they're doing. Oh, yeah, but little boy, what if they knew what they were doing? I forgive them anyway. Because on, I mean, the way I see it, on one level, they still don't know what they're doing. You know, oftentimes we can make mistakes, even though we know it might be wrong. You know, for instance, especially looking at the you know, around the karma, the kamma, you know, and trying to, oh, right, yeah, there's that. Maybe people don't understand the vipaka, the results of the actions, the results of the karma that they're generating. So the one of the sutta that really came to mind when I was, you know, during my sort of reflections on this, you know, when I've been thinking, is the simile of the saw. It's Kakachupama, I think that's how you pronounce it, sutta. It's number 21 in the middle length discourses, Majjhima Nikaya. And a lot of you will probably be familiar with at least part of the sutta. There's a, near the very end of the sutta, the Buddha uses a simile that if you are being cut apart limb by limb by bandits, limb by limb, you're alive, cut apart, that if for even a moment, you know, feelings of hatred are to arise in you, then you're not applying my teachings. You're not fully applying my teachings. And I, here, you know, talking about first time hearing something, when I first heard that many years ago, I was like, oh, come on. wasn't that I didn't believe it, or it was more like, how can you do that? You know, how can you do that? But it's interesting, I picked up this because that memory came into mind of that simile of the saw. And I went to reread the sutta. I had read it, but I couldn't remember the details. It was too long ago and not such a great memory. And interestingly enough, then there's a couple of story or a couple of examples that the Buddha uses building up to the, you know, going, working through the sutta. But they're around, most of the examples that he's using is around being spoken to in ways that are painful. Even though the simile at the end is obviously, it's physical. It's not bandits, you know, calling you names. It's bandits cutting you apart limb by limb with a saw. But the examples, as I said, it's around speech. So sort of, and the five examples he uses, which come up not just in the suttas, but also within our monk's discipline and guidelines, are around, is what's being said, is it timely or untimely? Is what's being said true or false? Is what's being said gentle or harsh? Is it being done in a gentle or harsh way? Or is what being said, is it leading to your welfare or to the welfare of people or things, or is it leading to harm? And then the fifth is it being done? Is it being said with a heart of loving kindness? Is it coming from loving kindness? And then, you know, so that's around the verbal realm. So I think it's probably safe to say that everybody in this room has been on the receiving end of both. Kindly speech, timely speech, all of those five categories. We've probably been on the positive end of the spectrum. But I think it's probably safe to say that we've all experienced some degree or form of the negative side. We've had harsh words or we have been the person to actually deliver kindly speech, and it's possible that we've also maybe spoken out in unkind ways, in unskillful ways. So So using that you know, using just that story of this doctor in New York, and thinking, well, you know, he was a lot closer to being cut apart than I've ever been. Just comparing it to my own experience as a human being in this life. And there he was, calm, tranquil. Apparently he was very clear in his mind. After the youths ran away, he was able to direct. Being a doctor, he could tell people what to do with his body. He was asking people to stay nearby until the police came so that he could give their names as witnesses. He was checking to see that his friend who was with him had not been hurt. This is clarity of mind after being severely beaten. And all of his injuries were in his head. So that can really rattle you, right? I'm guessing. It's never happened to me. And so I thought, well, it sounds like he was actually able to put into practice. Okay, his limbs were being cut off, but what the Buddha was saying. That anger did not arise in him. So when the interviewer went to the BBC interviewer went to the Sikh temple, and they were getting a bit of background on the Sikh faith, which is not a very old faith in terms of, you know, if you compare it to Christianity or Hinduism or Buddhism, it's about 500 years old, and it started in India. And there's been a lot of persecution of them, right? Sounds like pretty much from the start. And they've had some of their head gurus, like the head of the faith. Actually, one of them was cut apart, joint by joint. Is what they say happened to him. It was a sentence passed down on him by some powerful person. I don't know who it was. I can't remember. And apparently the person that had been, the way the story goes is that the sort of executor or the person that was supposed to do this to him, out of compassion, said, I'll cut off limb by limb instead of joint by joint to save you that pain, at least some pain. And the guru said, no. He said, that's not your instructions. You will be punished if you don't carry out your instructions. So do as you were told and do joint by joint. One finger joint, two finger joints, three, hand, elbow. And in this faith, they use that, the practitioners use the examples of extreme examples like this to help develop forgiveness, to help develop patience, to help develop this. They don't actually have a word in their tradition for being a victim. They don't have a word. So they don't tend to associate themselves as being victims, even though they're persecuted throughout history. And now persecuted, you know, this is only, what, 6-7 months ago in New York City, somebody beaten. The year before, there were 6 Sikh practitioners killed in Wisconsin at their temple. And they don't try to arm, like one of the things that this interviewer said when she went to the temple was, she said there was no armed guards, you know, there were no security, no sort of open protection. Kids were playing out front. So, no word for victim. And they have a word that's called jardikala. I think I'm saying that, jardikala, which means perpetual optimism. Perpetual optimism. My cynical side, I'm sort of an optimist in recovery, I think, still. When I took a Buddhist practice, I I thought, well, if I'm going to align myself with any sort of ism around optimism or pessimism, I'll go to realism. But I occasionally, you know, I can sort of relate to optimism, but my sort of skeptical, pessimistic side thought, perpetual optimism. But then I started thinking, well, wait a minute, that's just one translation of this word. And I didn't look it up. I didn't really want to. I just thought, well, you know, just in my own experience, how can I, what would that be? And then the thought came into my mind, loving kindness to me is in a way that optimism of holding a person or a situation acceptant, you know, that acceptance. I know Ajahn Amaro oftentimes refers to, one of the ways he refers to loving kindness or metta is radical acceptance. And other people translate metta as unconditional love or unconditional goodwill. And so that unconditionality is that, there's, at least the way I look at it, is that it's that acceptance. Oh, okay, I can accept this situation into my heart, into my consciousness sometimes. Sometimes we unconsciously don't accept things. But, you know, accept what's going on. Accept the person that's maybe speaking in ways that we find abusive or painful. This doctor accepted the situation, at least the way I see it. He accepted the fact that he was being beaten almost to the point of being unconscious, kicked, beaten in the head, on the street, 15 to 30 youths around him, and not knowing whether he would survive this attack. But there was an acceptance, is it what I feel that. Because to forgive, to me, yeah, there's a radical acceptance going on there. It's an acceptance, yeah, okay. Human being, made mistake, did wrong, but we can actually move beyond this. I can dwell in non-anger. And then the other thing around the perpetual optimism that came up for me, and both reading about this, you know, this letter that the doctor wrote in the program, was how much he wanted to not, as he said, I don't want these youths caught, I want them taught. And he put out an open invitation for them to visit the temple. I don't think that's happened. I'm not surprised. But he says, and people said, will you leave the community? You know, you live in that community. And he says, yeah, you know, it's quite possible. I've treated some of these young people as a doctor. I don't know. But I live with these people. And I want to continue helping my community. And I want to turn this around. I want to try and use whatever, and I'm paraphrasing, whatever shred he can of this experience to use it for good. So they had a recording of him going to visiting school and talking to the young people, talking to students about, you know, asking them, have you ever been bullied? Have you ever been attacked? How did that feel? And talking about his experience. So he's using that experience, but he says, no, my wife, my child, and I will not leave this community. We will not move from here. This is where we live. This is where we work. This is the community we serve. So you can sort of see how this got people's attention in the press. You know, at least I can. It's not exactly, you know, it's not the response that we often bump up against or maybe exhibit ourselves. I don't know. And so to me, yeah, that sort of, you know, that loving kindness and generosity and of him using that perpetual optimism, turning it around. And then I was thinking, you know, that phrase that we hear that Ajahn Chah, if I heard correctly, it's the title of one of the books of his that has been produced in the West of his talks, is, you know, everything is teaching us. Everything is teaching us. So to use every situation. So to me, that's a perpetual optimism. All right, wow, I just made a really huge mistake. I really stuffed up. It's painful, painful for me, painful for others. But we're encouraged to plow it back into the practice, plow it back in. Use it, learn from it. Well, what is that? What did that feel like? So, oh, okay, this was painful. And then folding it into, you know, all the work that, you know, we're all doing around mindfulness and clarity, so that we can not make those mistakes, hopefully, in the future. But if we only feed it in as a negative, like, you know, beating ourselves up, not forgiving ourselves. You know, how often is that the case, that we can easily forgive others but not forgive ourselves for something we've done or perceived that we've done, can't let go. Not treating ourselves with, you know, with that radical acceptance of, oh, myself, metta. Begin with myself. And then spreading outwards. So yeah, that sutta, the simile of the saw, it's, and the Buddha says, you know, that in the end of, you know, he goes through all these different similes within that around being spoken to in harsh ways, but that, yeah, not for a moment to dwell in anger, ill will, but to spread, you know, through compassion, with loving kindness, through non-ill will, through non-aversion, to begin with that very situation or person that maybe you're bumping up against, rubbing up against, to begin right there. And it's interesting, because a couple of weeks ago, Ajahn Poonadhammo was here, and if I remember correctly, part of the talk he gave, he spoke about something that he picked up, he had heard from the Dalai Lama around, you know, practicing things like compassion and loving kindness. It would just begin with one person. To begin with one, don't start big. Sometimes, just in case that's overwhelming and brings up feelings of oh, well, this is impossible. But to begin with something that is manageable, just with one person. So, for instance, in a situation, difficult situation, if it's one person or just a few, start right there. People are beating me. Do I need to dwell in hatred? Do I want to carry hatred around with me? And, you know, if we can keep developing the path, and build up that spiritual strength to be able to actually do that. What would our hearts be like if we could do that? Constantly forgiving, constantly able to bring forth patience and forgiveness in whatever situation we meet. And something that came to mind, and I don't know how accurate this is because I haven't heard the story told for a while, but because, you know, it's sort of like living in a community like this, you know, I you know, there's not a lot of, I haven't been spoken to harshly. I've only been back here a few months, but nobody has spoken to me harshly, not even out in San Francisco or Ukiah, or I was just down in Marin County. But there's a story that I think I've heard Ajahn Amaro probably tell it the most, about Ajahn Chah. Ajahn Chah went to England, I guess, twice, and in one of those visits, the way I remember the story is that Ajahn Chah and Ajahn Sumedho and one other bhikkhu, I'm not quite sure who it was, were walking, and either on alms round or just walking in central London. And this would have been the 70s, and I think it may have been like a punk or some interesting, quote-unquote, looking person approached them and confronted, I guess it was right in front of Ajahn Chah, and started throwing sort of fake punches, but not close enough to hit, and kicks, sort of maybe even sort of some sort of martial arts, I can't remember. And this kind of went on, and apparently Ajahn Sumedho was kind of like, okay, what's going to happen here? Does something need to happen here in terms of intervention? But apparently Ajahn Chah was just standing there, and the person confronting them finally stopped and walked away. And Ajahn Chah's words, he turned around and said, "Good place for practice. This is a good place for practice." And so, to me, that's perpetual optimism. Feeding it back into our practice, instead of thinking, oh, Buddhist monks can't be here in the West or in this city because people won't understand or whatever. I've never lived in a Buddhist country, so I don't know. But, you know, oh, good place for practice. Because what are we going to work with? Because that's one of the things about the Sutta number 21, the simile of the saw, is the way it starts out, is it? Well, there's two examples. One of the examples that comes up is that there was a woman, I guess she was quite wealthy, she was the woman of the household, head of the household, and one of her servants. And the woman of the household was known to be very peaceful, calm, kind, and one of her house girls, servants thought, well, why don't I test her and see how calm and kind she is? And so she decided, tomorrow morning I'll get up late. I won't get up early for my work. And so she does so, and the lady of the household says, "Kali, come here." Okay, she comes. What is this? You're sleeping late. She goes, "Oh no, I just slept late." So she spoke to her servant quite harshly, but not so harshly. So the servant thinks, "Well, I'll try a little harder tomorrow." So she gets up even later, and the head of the household speaks to Kali, the servant, more sharply and in more unfriendly terms. And this goes on a few times until the point that I think the lady of the household picks up a rolling pin and hits her servant over, beats her on the head, and so she's bleeding, and she goes out of the house and says, "You see how kindly and gentle my master is, my mistress is. She, you know, just because I sleep late, get up late, she's beating me and speaking unkindly." And so the Buddha, the way the Buddha relates, well, the reason he's saying this is he's also talking about, you know, relating it to how, for instance, monks take to being given feedback. So, can we? Yeah, are we being peaceful? Are we being calm and tranquil? Just either to get something, or just when things are going our way. So that's to me, that's the real key thing around that sutta. When do we get tested? So there's Ajahn Chah and the two monks getting tested. Somebody that they're really not sure about doing karate kicks or whatever, punches, not striking, but being quite threatening. Good place for practice. So, because sometimes, you know, the big question that a lot of people have when they come to visit monasteries is, well, how can I practice in the world? How can I do this? Or monks that, you know, we can say, well, you know, no, I can, I need to, you know, I don't want to go out because difficult for practice, and it may or may not be true depending on the individual or depending on how long we've been doing this. That's for sure, that's to be considered. But in a way, having that person scream at you out on the streets of some city, maybe that's what we need to test, because if we aren't really truly stable in the heart, if we aren't really dwelling in equanimity, if we still are reactive, at least I want to know that in myself. I want to see that. I want to know, oh, this is my response to the situation. Like I said earlier, if I asked the question, if I was beaten like this Dr. Singh, what would my response be? But whatever it is, I would hopefully, I hope, and this is an ideal and I have no idea, but I'd hope at least that I could learn from it. Even if I did develop, you know, hatred or have moments of hatred, to learn, so to use this as our good place of practice. It's hard, it's an ideal. It's an ideal. But to reach, you know, that unshakable peace, if everything's going our way, if we're never tested, I know, I mean, that's one of the things I find about moving communities, going between different monasteries, which I've done very little of, but is seeing different things that push my buttons. And in a way, I could take up the stance, well, no, this place doesn't suit me because this pushes my buttons, but no, I need to see this. I need to see this. Good place for practice. So, anyway, I've been talking a long time, but time does fly. These are just, yeah, some thoughts around this, because it is a story that, you know, a real life story that I found quite moving, quite touching, and I'm still reflecting around this. So I'll offer this for reflection, and maybe it'll bring up some aspects that other people can reflect on as well. So. Mm-hmm.